Humphrey stumbled forward. It took everything he had to put one foot in front of the other, but he persisted despite the immense effort it required. The knife wound in his shoulder had become infected 2 days ago. Or was it three? He was no longer certain. The days began to blur together as the pain spread and his fever grew. To make matters worse, he couldn't trust his ability to recognize the passage of time. Twice now, he'd come to his senses to find himself stumbling through unfamiliar territory, his body powering him onward, while his brain had been on hiatus. His vision was growing progressively more blurry as the afternoon wore on. Possibly the glancing blow he'd taken to the side of the head during his escape hadn't been that glancing after all. The expedition had started out well enough. The map had been a godsend. Farini had laid out the steps they were to follow with a surveyor's precision, and Humphrey had taken his team from one waypoint to the next with minimal difficulty. Each time they'd located another of Farini's landmarks, Humphrey had grown more convinced they would find the lost city of the Kalahari, just as Farini and his son had done nearly a century earlier. Everything had been progressing just as planned. That was, until Barnes shot the San tribesman. The mean-hearted bastard claimed it was an accident, but Humphrey had overheard talk of bagging a trophy, as if the natives of the Kalahari were no better than the wildlife around them. They had awoken the morning after the San's death to find the tires on all their vehicles slashed and all their gas tanks punctured and empty. A look under the vehicle's hoods had revealed even more damage. More than the destruction, what frightened Humphrey was the fact that all this had been done while the men slept only a few feet away. Not one of them had heard the San. Humphrey knew he had entirely lost control of the expedition at that point. His pleas to try to communicate with the tribesmen had been shouted down by the more militant members of his entourage, and soon there had been a mini coup, as he was supplanted in his role of expedition leader by none other than that idiot, Barnes. Fool. He deserved everything he'd gotten as a result. They'd tied Humphrey's hands and lashed him to a nearby baobab tree to keep him from interfering as they'd settled into defensive positions around the camp, ready for the tribesmen should they return. Stumbling along, Humphrey shook his head at the memory. The San had come with a vengeance, and within moments of their arrival, the entire camp had been engulfed in chaos. He knew he would never forget the sight of the San leader on a massive bull elephant as it reared over Barnes, ready to crush him with its forelegs. The knife wound had come from one of his own men. Possible concussion was a gift from a San tribesman with a club made of elephant bone. Humphrey had been on the run since. The Kalahari Desert was not a forgiving place, and even in his fevered state, he knew that if he didn't find help and shelter soon, he wouldn't live to see next week. It took everything he had just to keep moving forward. A full moon, when had it become night, gave him just enough light to avoid the major obstacles in his path. Not that there were all that many. Aside from the occasional baobab tree, the Kalahari was pretty much flat pans and scrubland. He used the moon as a guide, stumbling toward it to prevent himself from traveling in circles. Humphrey spun, nearly toppling to the ground. All he saw was the mottled brown back of an animal keeping pace with him. Fear pooled in his belly. Hyenas. Humphrey had been in Africa long enough to recognize the hyena call to alert the rest of the pack of a food source. In minutes, he would be surrounded. He couldn't outrun them. His only hope was to find a place where he could hole up away from them and wait for the pack to grow discouraged and wander away. Humphrey staggered on, lost in delirium. And when he came to his senses next, his two hyena companions had grown to a pack of six or more. They moved through the scrub on all sides of him. Tears began to course down his cheeks, matching the blood now running down his arm as his exertion reopened his shoulder wound. One foot in front of the other. One foot in front of the other. The lead hyena dashed toward him from the side. He turned to face it, waving his arms, and it broke off the charge, disappearing into the darkness. Humphrey glanced around, searching desperately for something, anything that could help him, when his gaze fell upon a large baobab tree about 100 yards off to his left. He angled his path in that direction and wanted to shout for joy when he reached the massive trunk of the baobab tree. He couldn't climb it. The nearest branches were 30 feet above his head. But with his back against it, he would at least be safe from an attack from behind. Humphrey had reached the end of his endurance. His legs wouldn't even hold him upright anymore. He slid to the ground, his feet splayed out before him. His hands fell on some of the hard, baseball-sized fruit scattered at the base of the tree, and he snatched them up. They were a poor excuse for a weapon, but they would have to do. He got to test them out a few seconds later. He struck the hyena's nose, startling it enough that it retreated into the scrub. 3 more of the hyenas advanced out of the brush and cautiously made their way forward.
Go away! Beat it, go on!
Humphrey felt around on the ground beside him until he found a good-sized rock. He clutched it, determined to defend himself to the last. The hyenas crept forward, their muzzles low to the ground, their lips pulled back. Suddenly, the lead hyena's ears pointed forward. A moment passed, and then the trio turned as one, dashing into the darkness. Even in the depths of his fever, Humphrey knew their sudden departure wasn't a good sign. Only a lion or some other large predator could make a pack of hyenas abandon an all but certain kill. He gripped his makeshift weapon tighter and prepared for the worst. A minute passed. 2. Humphrey's vision swam, and his head began to sag toward his chest as darkness sought to drag him down. A San tribesman was squatting a few feet in front of him, watching him with eyes as emotionless as slate. He wore nothing but a loincloth, the rest of his skin covered with some kind of muddy paste that would make it easy for him to blend into the background. In his left hand, he held a spear, the butt of which rested on the ground, the tip pointing skyward. Without a change of expression, the San warrior raised his other hand to his mouth. Humphrey watched a cloud of dust burst from the man's closed fist. His throat closed up immediately. He fought to take in another breath, but it was no use. The darkness closed in quickly, his view of the San warrior in front of him swiftly dwindling until all he could see was the man's dark eyes. Then the darkness claimed him entirely.
Graphic Audio presents Rogue Angel by Alex Archer. Rogue Angel number 42, The Vanishing Tribe. Narrated by Nanette Savard. With performances by Colleen Delaney, Bradley Smith, James Lewis, Thomas Keegan, Patrick Busink, Danny Gavigan, Kenyatta Rogers, Ken Jackson, Yasmin Twazon, Joe Brack, Michael Glenn, Terrence Aselford, and Dylan Lynch.
Anya Creed glanced across the platform to where her cameraman, Lenny Davis, was seated. In the dim light, he was hard to see, but she knew where he was because they'd both been sitting in the same place for 2 weeks. The two were deep in the Jiundu swamp in northwestern Botswana, following up on a recent rash of Batmen sightings and trying to catch some footage of the alleged creature. It was their latest assignment for Chasing History's Monsters, the cable television show Anya co-hosted. The show focused on exactly what its name indicated: historical madmen, psychopaths, serial killers, and even legendary monsters. Hence the reason they were on a platform 10 feet off the ground, using low-light cameras to try to catch a glimpse of what their producer, Doug Morrell, was calling the scoop of the century. Of course, he'd said the same thing about the past 3 assignments he'd sent them on, including one where he'd had them trying to film the ghost of a man-eating great white shark off the coast of Indonesia, which was why Anya didn't place much stock in his assessment. She stretched her legs out in front of her, trying to keep from cramping.
Did you hear that?
I didn't hear anything.
There it is again! Listen!
Lenny climbed to his feet, silhouetted in the dim moonlight. This time, Anya did hear something. It was faint, hard to identify over the typical night noises coming out of the swamp.
I hear it. But what the heck is it?
Anya didn't think for a moment that it was an actual Batman. She was expecting to find a perfectly natural explanation for the so-called sightings that had occurred over the past several months. An unusually large vulture, perhaps. Or maybe some unknown species of bird, driven out of the deeper swamps by the recent rainy season. Either would make far more sense than the mysterious bat people Doug was convinced were hiding here. Anya rose to her feet and tried to get a fix on the sound. It was getting closer, but she couldn't pin down which direction it was coming from. The quarter moon wasn't much help. What little light it cast added more shadows than it illuminated.
Behind you!
Anya turned just in time to see a dark winged shape swoop down at her from the nearby tree with stunning speed. She dropped into a crouch, bringing her arms up over her head to protect herself as the thing flew past. She quickly got back to her feet, but it had already disappeared into the darkness.
What the hell was that?
Anya didn't have any answers. She'd barely gotten a glance at it. But it could also be the very thing that they'd come to find. The Batmen of Botswana.
Get those cameras rolling, Lenny.
Cameras 1, 2, and 3 are live. 4 is giving me some trouble, but I should have it online in another moment or two.
Good, we don't want to miss this thing a second.
Look out!
Anya was turning when she felt claws rake her left shoulder. Pain flared down her arm, and then the thing was gone again. If it came back, which it most likely would, this time she would be prepared to meet it on its own terms. She'd been using a walking stick to help her navigate the uncertain terrain of the swamp for the past few days, and she snatched it up now, holding it before her in two hands like a baseball bat.
Do you see it?
Lenny didn't respond. He was standing with his back to her, fumbling with something in front of him that she couldn't see.
Something isn't right. That strange buzzing sound the creature makes whenever it swipes at us, the lack of aerobatics from a creature supposedly born to fly, Lenny's current distraction. Oh, geez, Louise, I can't believe it took me so long to figure it out.
It's coming back, I think!
This time, Anya was ready for it. She had some idea what was causing that sound now, and she intended to put her theory to the test.
Here it comes again!
Suddenly, the creature was diving at them for the third time that night. Anya brought her staff around in a vicious swing.
No, Anya!
Anya saw the creature go careening off in an uncontrolled spin. A moment later, it crashed 10 feet below them. Anya headed for the ladder.
What are you doing?
Putting an end to this right now.
Anya descended from the platform and then pulled her flashlight out of her pocket. Flipping it on, she cast about for a few minutes before locating the object she'd struck with her staff. She hurried over and shone her light on the wreckage. The so-called Batman was in reality nothing more than a medium-sized drone with a pair of motorized wings and some special effects added to give the suggestion of something more when glimpsed in the near dark. Anya looked up as Lenny finally joined her. Her expression must have reflected a fair bit of what she was feeling because he winced.
I think you have some explaining to do.
Would you believe this was all Doug's idea?
I would indeed.
After listening to Lenny's explanation about the drone, Anya decided she was done with the episode and stalked back to their rented Nissan SUV. Lenny followed sheepishly in her wake. The ride back to their hotel passed in silence, and Anya retired to her room as soon as they arrived. There, she finally got a chance to look at the shoulder wound. It turned out to be minor, a deep scrape most likely caused by the outer edge of the drone's wing as it swept past her. She cleaned it out, bandaged it, and fell into bed exhausted. The sun woke Anya just after 9 the next morning. She rose, dressed, and ran through her usual routine of morning stretches to awaken her body in preparation for the harder exercise to follow. This morning, her arm was a little stiff, but she quickly worked out the kinks as she ran through her warm-up exercises. When her muscles were good and limber, she reached into the otherwear. The gleaming medieval broadsword appeared in her hand. Her life hadn't been the same since that fateful day when she'd brought the broken, scattered pieces of the sword together for the first time since their original owner, Joan of Arc, had been burned at the stake 500 years earlier. The sword had miraculously reformed in a flash of power right before her very eyes, and in some strange way she still didn't understand, had chosen her to be its next bearer. The role came with its own unique set of responsibilities, protecting the innocent first and foremost among them. It wasn't a life she would have chosen for herself, but now that she was in it, she couldn't imagine doing anything else. Anya slipped into a series of movements designed to continue honing her already considerable skills with the weapon. Kata after kata flowed out of her as naturally as water from a spring, and Anya quickly found herself lost in the synergy of thought and motion, becoming one with the sword in such a way that it ceased being a separate object, but was instead an extension of body and mind. When she finally slowed to a stop over an hour later, she felt energized and ready to take on the day. She released the sword back into the otherwear. Anya showered, changed, and left the hotel behind, looking for a place to eat. Upon arrival in Botswana, they had set up a base of operations in Maun, the district capital of northwestern Botswana, that served as the jumping-off point for exploration of the Okavango Delta to the north and the Makati-Kati salt pans to the east. What had once been a small village along the wide banks of the Thalamakane River had grown over the past couple of decades into a town of some 40,000 people. It was an interesting mixture of the old and the new, where hotels, lodges, and even a rental car facility vied for room with square cinder block homes with tin roofs and small herds of donkeys and goats every morning when the local farmers brought their goods to market. Anya found a small cafe just down the street from the hotel and had a leisurely breakfast. When her breakfast was over, she snatched up her cell phone, dialed the familiar New York number, and waited.
Doug Morrell.
What do you think you're doing?
Right now, I'm drafting a memo to marketing about...
Don't give me that nonsense. You know exactly what I'm talking about.
Actually, I don't. I can hear that you're upset, Anya, but...
Of course I'm upset. Did you think I wouldn't find out?
Find out about what? I really don't understand.
You had the special effects department create a simulated Batman and coerced my cameraman into using it when it looked like we wouldn't get any real footage. Something I told you would happen before we even left the States.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Anya.
Good. Then you certainly won't mind that I practiced my Babe Ruth impression on it with my hiking staff and knocked it out of the sky in mid-flight.
What? Are you insane? Do you have any idea what that thing costs? Effects is going to kill me. Never mind what accounting is going to do with my budget.
I thought you had no idea what I was talking about.
It was strictly a backup plan.
Anya let him babble for several minutes as she sipped her coffee. Doug had tried to enhance, his word, not hers, her shows with special effects in the past, and each time she'd soundly shot him down. This time he'd conspired to do it behind her back, with her cameraman, no less. A message needed to be sent.
And so I took it upon myself to support you.
Doug?
Yes, Anya?
I'm taking the day off, Doug. I'm going to do a little shopping, eat out at an expensive restaurant, and generally enjoy myself. Come tomorrow, when I'm in a better mood, we'll talk about what we're going to do next. Understood? Good.
Anya finished her coffee, paid the check, and then stepped out the door. There were several clothing stores around the cafe where she'd just had breakfast. If she didn't find anything there, she would wander back past the hotel to the large outdoor bazaar that filled the streets for several blocks in that direction. The first couple of stores didn't have anything that interested her, but the third one was full of fabrics dyed in brilliant hues, and she quickly fell in love with several items. The proprietor, a woman a few years younger than Anya, took particular pride in showing her around the shop. She quickly found her irritation at Doug and the events of the night before slipping away in the wake of the young woman's enthusiasm over helping her. In the end, Anya bought several brightly colored tops and even a beautifully cut sundress just to show her appreciation. Anya was headed out of the shop when a small white sign stuck in the corner of the window caught her eye. She leaned closer for a better look.
Public notice of auction. Personal effects of explorer and adventurer Robert C. Humphrey. Willoughby's Auction House, 10 a.m. today only.
Robert Humphrey. I know that name.
A glance at her watch told Anya it was a few minutes before 10. If she hurried, she might just make it. She stepped back inside the shop.
Forget something, miss?
Willoughby's Auction House. Is it far?
No, miss. Not far at all. 4 blocks up on the right, above the post office. Thanks.
Anya hurried up the street. The post office wasn't hard to find, and a quick question to one of the locals standing in line outside brought her around the side of the building where a staircase led up to the second floor. A door at the top opened up into a wide room that was clearly the site of the event, even if the large Willoughby's banner across the back of the room was any indication. The auction was already underway when Anya slipped inside and found a seat in the back. She was surprised by the turnout. About 2 dozen people, many of them clearly not locals, filled the rows of chairs in front of the auctioneer's podium. The sale moved along briskly, and Anya was amazed, not only by the scope and variety of the items up for bid, but also the amounts individual buyers were willing to pay for them. Humphrey, she remembered, had once been a highly respected adventurer. He'd been the height of celebrity back in the mid-80s, thanks to a series of well-publicized activities, such as climbing without oxygen, the highest mountain on each continent, dog sledding solo across the South Pole, and breaking the record for circumnavigating the Earth by hot air balloon. Then a tabloid paper had revealed that Humphrey had sunk several million dollars into an effort to prove the existence of the abominable snowman, or Yeti. The public had laughed it off. But then other reporters began digging deeper, and it quickly became apparent that Humphrey had more than just one pet project. UFOs, pyramid power, Bigfoot, Nessie, the Hollow Earth theory. Name just about any subject on the outer edge of science and myth, and Humphrey was involved in it somehow. When the information came to light, he went public with his enthusiasm for all things esoteric and paranormal. The reporters went on a feeding frenzy. Humphrey had withdrawn from the public eye for many years. From time to time, you would hear that he was involved in some crazy expedition or another, like the time he'd tried to retrace the route taken through the Amazon jungle by Colonel Percy Fawcett in his quest to find the ancient city known only as Z. Listening in on the conversations around her, Anya learned that Humphrey had been living here in Maun for at least the past 10 years, possibly longer. He'd disappear into the outback for weeks at a time, hunting for who knew what.
Maybe he was looking for the Batman of Jiundu as well. He certainly chased crazier ideas than that.
Humphrey and his entire expedition had disappeared 2 years ago while chasing down the legend of the lost city of the Kalahari, an ancient city of enormous proportions, supposedly built by the ancestors of the modern-day San tribesmen. Given that the San had been one of the most nomadic peoples on the planet, Anya found the idea that they'd built a massive city in the desert ludicrous. She was just about to get up and make her way out of the auction when a new item was introduced that caught her eye. It was a small drawing on what looked to be old parchment paper, mounted in a simple wooden frame.
Our next piece shows an artist's representation of Lake Makarikari in its heyday, somewhere around 20,000 years ago. Mr. Humphrey's records indicate that this drawing was done by a man named Girolamo Farini in 1895, though we have not been able to substantiate his claim. Is it possible? Certainly. Is it likely? I'm afraid we can't answer that. So, let's start the bidding on this fine piece at $50. Do I hear 50?
On impulse, Anya raised her hand.
$50 from the lady in the 8th row. Do I hear 75? $75!
A man a few rows in front of Anya raised his hand.
75 it is. Can I get 100? $100!
Anya's hand went up a second time.
$100! Do I hear 125?
For a moment, Anya thought the man a few rows ahead of her was going to bid again, but he must have thought better of it. He let the moment pass.
125! Do I hear 125? No? Then it's $100 going once, $100 going twice, and sold to the woman in the 8th row.
No sooner had the auctioneer finished than the doors in the back of the room were thrown open and a man rushed inside.
Stop! Stop right now!
He was a big man, both in height and weight. His blonde hair fell just over the collar of his white Panama suit, and his blue eyes were wide. He rushed down the center aisle toward the auctioneer, a mountain of a man moving with far more dexterity than Anya would have imagined possible.
That drawing belongs to me!
I am sorry, sir, but you are too late.
Too late? Do you have any idea who I am? That drawing belongs to me, I tell you!
And I'm telling you, sir, that the image belongs to the young lady in the eighth row who just legally purchased it.
Anya watched as the big man spun around, his gaze first seeking and then finding her in her seat. She watched as the big man stalked toward her. She could see he was younger than she'd first thought, definitely closer to 20 than 30. But that still didn't give her any clue as to who he was or why he thought the drawing belonged to him. He stopped and stood over her, glaring down.
That drawing belongs to me. I said that—
I know what you said, but I'm afraid I have to disagree. The art belongs to me. If you wanted it, you should have been here to bid on it.
Do you know who I am? Do you have any idea how difficult I can make things for you?
He leaned in close and shoved a finger in her face.
You have no idea what you've gotten yourself into.
Without a change of expression, Anya grabbed his finger and twisted it. Then she stood. Anya applied pressure to his finger in such a way that he was forced to let her lead him.
Didn't your mother teach you not to point?
She was about to lead him down the aisle and out of the doors. Instead, she glanced up as four men in blue shirts and black slacks crossed the room toward her.
Security, miss. We're here to escort Mr. Potter out.
Be my guest.
They grabbed his arms and pulled him away. He didn't fight them, choosing instead to simply glare at Anya as they led him away. She gave him a smile and a wave.
Are you all right, miss?
Anya turned to find the auctioneer beside her.
I'm fine, really. Did you know him?
Unfortunately. That's Malcolm Porter, the son of the late Mr. Humphrey. He's been calling our offices for weeks ever since his father was officially declared dead, determined to get his hands on the man's property. But the will was quite clear that it was all to be auctioned off.
Well, thank you for your concern. I'd best be going.
The auctioneer pointed to the connecting doorway not too far from where she had been sitting.
You can pick up your item in the next room. And I suggest using the back stairwell rather than the front one. There's no telling what Porter will do, and once you're off the property, there is little we can do to stop him.
Of course. Thanks again. Goodbye.
Anya double-checked that she had her cell phone, and then headed for the door he'd indicated. Her package was waiting for her, as he'd said, wrapped in white paper and tied with a piece of twine to make it easy to carry. That was unusual, she thought, not to be able to verify that she'd been given the correct item. Shrugging, she thanked the clerk and then took the back stairs, as the auctioneer had suggested. When she got to her hotel room, with some relief, she unwrapped and set the framed picture on the table next to the bed, then dug her laptop out of her backpack. Firing it up, she began searching for information on Gilarmi Farini. She immediately got a fair number of hits. The man born William Leonard Hunt took the stage name Farini the Great for his tightrope walking act over Niagara Falls. As his fame increased, he legally changed his name to Gilarmi A. Farini and moved his shows to Coney Island. When they did particularly well, he took them on the road, often to London. He made several trips to Zimbabwe and South Africa, and it was after one of these trips that he returned to London with six bushmen, members of the Khoi Khoi tribe from the Kalahari region. Farini convinced them to work for him as part of a show entitled Farini's African Pygmies, which was essentially an exposé of life in the Kalahari. It proved very successful in London. Farini's relationship with the Bushmen made him privy to many of their legends. He was particularly interested in their stories of a lost city deep in the Kalahari, especially after they told him the city was full of diamonds just waiting to be picked off the streets.
If it isn't gold, it's diamonds. When will these guys learn?
Farini, his son, Lulu, and a hired associate sailed for Cape Town in January 1895. They arrived by month's end, and by mid-February they were headed for the Kalahari. They spent 6 months in the desert, returning in July, claiming to have found a lost city of epic proportions.
Anya was surprised to learn that they had accompanying photographs to support their claims. She spent some time digging around on the net until she found the photographs. They showed massive stone blocks stacked on top of one another in what looked to be man-made fashion. In fact, it reminded her of the Great Wall of China.
Did Farini actually find something in the depths of the Kalahari?
Farini had returned to London and given several lectures on his discovery, most notably to the Royal Geographic Society and later to the Berlin Geographic Society. A book, Through the Kalahari, which included those same photographs taken by Lulu, and a London-based Lost City exhibition soon followed. After that, Farini faded from public view until he died on his ranch in Ontario in 1929, without ever having returned to the Lost City. He did, however, pen some poetry about the place in his later years.
A half-buried ruin, a huge wreck of stones, on a lonely and desolate spot. A temple or tomb for human bones, left by man to decay and rot. Rude sculpted blocks from the red sand project, and shapeless uncouth stones appear. Some great man's ashes, designed to protect, buried many a thousand year. A relic, perhaps, of a glorious past, a city once grand and sublime, destroyed by the quake, defaced by the blast, swept away by the hands of time. Robert Frost he was not.
Anya picked up the framed map and compared it to some of the hand-drawn images Farini's son had included in Through the Kalahari. The style was the same, swift, sure pencil strokes with an occasional finer detail.
Why draw what the lake might have looked like thousands of years ago when sketching the lake bed would make more sense for a map? They probably crossed straight through the center of it. No matter. It's a nice piece and will look good in my apartment.
Her curiosity satisfied on one account, Anya turned her attention to Malcolm Porter. There wasn't as much information on Porter as there had been on Farini, which was the opposite of what Anya had expected. Porter lived in the era of Google, Facebook, and the paparazzi, after all. The son of a celebrity, even one known more for his general wackiness than anything else, should have generated more than just the occasional note in the society pages. It piqued Anya's curiosity.
How has he escaped notice with such a notorious father?
Then her eyes fell on the word used to describe him in each of the articles she'd managed to dig up.
Estranged. Malcolm Porter, the estranged son of Robert Humphrey, was seen tonight at the gala opening of Chef Hiroto's new restaurant. Hiroto, a three-time Michelin star winner, was... Why estranged? Is that why Humphrey left him out of his will?
It seemed harsh, but Anya didn't know the story behind their estrangement. She had to believe it was something big that had set the two of them at odds. After all, Porter had apparently taken his mother's last name in protest against his father. Anya couldn't stay angry at Lenny for doing what Doug had ordered him to do, so she agreed to have dinner with him that night. As it turned out, Anya arrived at the restaurant, a quiet little place a few blocks away from their hotel, before he did. She took a table in the back away from most of the other patrons and ordered a glass of wine. She was lost in thought, thinking about the sketch she'd purchased earlier that day, when she sensed someone approaching her table. Expecting to find the waiter with her glass of wine, she was surprised to see Malcolm Porter, dressed in the same tropical weight suit she'd seen him in earlier.
May I speak with you a moment, Miss Creed?
If you wish. Have a seat.
Thank you. I want to apologize. My behavior today was unacceptable. I trust you will forgive me. I'm willing to give you twice what you paid for the drawing. Just tell me how much you would like me to make the check out for.
It's not for sale.
Not enough, then. You drive a hard bargain, Miss Creed. Three times what you paid, then.
You seem to be going to an awful lot of trouble for such an innocuous item, Mr. Porter. May I ask why?
It has a great deal of sentimental value to me.
Oh?
Yes. My father gave it to me when I was a child, and for many years I thought it was lost. I only recently found out that it was on the list of items to be auctioned and hurried here to claim it before it went on the block. Oh, clearly my frustration got the better of me when I was too late.
Seems an unusual gift for a young boy.
I was enthralled with maps and images of faraway places as a child. My father knew that a drawing of a special location in the heart of deepest, darkest Africa, as they used to say, would interest me. So, three times what you paid seems very fair. Do we have a deal?
As I've already said, the image isn't for sale.
I dislike being denied, Miss Creed. Very few people get in my way and come out better off.
Is that a threat?
Take it however you want. I'm just stating facts.
Anya leaned back in her seat. She let her right hand slip casually down into her lap, where it was hidden from the sight of both Porter and the other restaurant patrons. Anya pushed her arm forward just far enough that the point of her sword poked Porter in his ample gut.
If you so much as look at me the wrong way again, I'll make sure you come to regret it.
Porter glanced down, saw the tip of her sword, and blanched. He looked up to find Anya staring at him.
Get out of here before I have you thrown out of a second place.
Porter scrambled from his seat and took several steps away.
No one threatens me. I'll have that drawing one way or another.
The next time I see you, I won't be so forgiving.
The waiter appeared with Lenny in tow. Porter angrily pushed past them and headed for the exit.
Was that Malcolm Porter?
Unfortunately.
Anya sent the sword back to the other wearer before anyone could see it. The waiter, an older gentleman with a thick shock of white hair, glanced after Porter uneasily.
Is everything all right?
Anya nodded and waited for him to leave with Lenny's order before she filled her cameraman in on what had happened earlier in the day.
Weird. With all the stuff Humphrey collected before he disappeared, you'd think his estranged son would want something more valuable, you know?
There were some really nice pieces up for auction, any one of which commanded a lot more than what I paid for that little drawing. If I was going to claim my old man left me something without telling anyone else, it certainly wouldn't have been that.
I don't think anyone would have believed him if he tried. There aren't too many fathers out there who wind up leaving the family fortune to a son who curses their name in public.
What's the story?
He and Daddy had a major falling out several years ago, right about the time Humphrey went public with all that craziness of his. Seems Junior didn't like Daddy turning his legacy into a joke. Make a long story short, two of them ended up taking their arguments to the media, sniping at each other every chance they could get. Daddy eventually had enough and wrote Junior out of his will. Junior, in a very public meltdown, cursed his father seven ways from Sunday, declared he was no longer his son, and took his mother's maiden name.
I'll bet that was effective.
You'd be right. Daddy barely noticed before he was off on another expedition, hunting a rare something or other halfway across the globe.
Do you think Porter had anything to do with his father's disappearance?
Nah, you've seen him in action. Not exactly the mastermind type now, is he?
But that didn't mean the man wasn't capable of malice. His obsession with the painting was proof enough of that. It seemed there was more to Mr. Malcolm Porter than Anya had first expected. Despite Porter's interruption, dinner proved to be a fun, relaxing affair. Lenny was new to the show, new to the network for that matter, and he hadn't been there long enough to learn which orders of Doug's were acceptable and which ones crossed any number of lines. They spent the meal swapping stories, just as they'd been doing since first climbing into that hide in the swamp 2 weeks ago. Lenny had worked for a variety of cable stations as an on-location cameraman, and he'd been on the road almost as much as she had over the past several years. The owner came by to let them know that they would be closing soon, and it was only then that Anya realized they were the last two customers in the entire restaurant. They paid the bill and then headed back down the street the few blocks to their hotel. They'd both had a few drinks. She was feeling reckless, and for a few minutes she considered inviting him to the bar for a nightcap. In the end, however, she went to her room on the second floor. As Anya got off the elevator, she noticed the door to her room was slightly ajar. She stopped, staring at the narrow crack of light that spilled out between the door and the jamb.
I closed the door firmly behind myself on the way out. I'm sure of it.
Anya glanced up and down the hallway, but there was no one else around. She was alone. Ready to take on whatever might be waiting for her, she quietly began to edge forward until she stood with her back to the wall, the open door just another step beyond. She leaned forward slightly and peeked inside. Anya's hotel room was expansive by Botswanan standards. A wide, open suite with a sitting living room area, a sleeping area, and a private bathroom. From her current position, she could see a small slice of the sitting area, a corner table, the end of the couch, but that was all. Reaching out with the tip of her sword, she gently eased the door open farther and waited for a response. When one wasn't immediately forthcoming, she stepped into the room, the sword extended before her on guard. There was no one there. The room was empty. It was immediately clear that someone had been inside. Her clothes and other belongings were strewn about as if that person had gone through them in a hurry. Her passport folder and the assorted credit cards it contained was still untouched on the bedside table.
Whoever was in here was looking for something specific, and I have a pretty good idea what that something is. Hopefully, my hiding it before going out for the evening has kept it safe.
As Anya walked toward the bathroom, she couldn't help but wonder again just what was so special about the image.
What good would a sketch of a lake that hasn't existed for the past 10,000 years do anyone?
Anya stepped into the bathroom, took the cover off the toilet, and fished the zipped plastic bag out of the tank. They either hadn't thought to look there, or her arrival had scared them away before they'd had the chance. Either way, the drawing was safe. She grabbed a towel off the rack. Anya took the package into the common room, drying it as she went. She put it down on the table and was about to sit down. She spun around, hands coming up to defend herself. The room behind her was empty, and yet it wasn't. She could feel it in her bones, that sense that there was someone else in the room, even though she couldn't see anyone there. Then her gaze fell on the tall wardrobe by the bed. The doors faced her directly and were open the barest fraction of an inch.
I know you're in there. We can do this the easy way or the hard way. Your choice. Suit yourself.
Anya advanced toward the wardrobe, her gaze glued to the crack between the doors, watching for the slightest movement. She stopped about 2 feet in front of the wardrobe, her sword between her and the doors.
Last chance.
With a rueful shake of her head, Anya reached out with the tip of her sword and knocked one of the doors wide open. She found herself staring at the empty wardrobe before her. The entire piece of furniture suddenly toppled toward her. She dove out of the way. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw a man dart out. He snatched the double-bagged picture off the table and turned toward the door, intent on making an escape. Anya scrambled to her feet and rushed after him. Anya's arms wrapped around the intruder's legs. He began squirming like a fish out of water, twisting and turning, pounding her on the head and shoulders with his free hand in an effort to free himself. He pulled away from her, only to find that Anya was between him and the door. Anya grinned. Now that they were facing each other, she could see that he was just a teenager. He couldn't have been more than 16 or 17. He wore clean clothes and a white pair of sneakers that practically shouted their newness. To her surprise, the cheeky kid smiled back.
Oh, no, you don't!
He crashed through the wooden shutters that covered the threshold to the narrow balcony and disappeared from view. Anya reached the shattered remains of the shutters just in time to see him leap over the low balcony railing and land on the brightly colored awning that extended from the hotel out into the street. He rolled once, twice, and then, with impressive dexterity, grabbed the edge of the awning and swung down to the street below. Anya stepped past the wreckage of the door, put her hand on the railing, and vaulted over it. She fell about 6 feet before striking the awning, which slowed her fall and sent her into a rolling tumble down its length. She grabbed the supporting pole and came to an abrupt halt, hanging half off the fabric, her feet a foot or so above the ground. She dropped to the ground, determined which course her target had taken, and saw him just disappearing around the corner at an intersection up ahead. By the time she reached the corner, he was out of sight, but the commotion he left in his wake allowed her to follow him easily enough. She pushed herself harder, and it wasn't long before she saw him moving in and out of the crowd ahead of her. She could see immediately that he had slowed down, no doubt thinking that he'd left her behind, and so she was able to close the distance between them without too much effort. Anya decided to take the risk of following him instead of taking back what was hers. She was now less than 10 yards behind the thief. She could see the package he'd taken tucked up under one arm as he made his way through the streets. From her explorations earlier in the day, Anya knew that the route he was taking would bring him to a large open-air plaza frequented by many locals. It was an ideal place for meeting someone without fear of being hemmed in. She also knew that there were other, faster routes to the same location. If she could get there ahead of him, she might be able to see who he was going to meet. Anya darted down a side street and pushed herself faster. She was quite a sight as she raced down the alley, dodging pedestrians. She didn't care. All that mattered was getting there before her target. The plaza was roughly 100 feet square, with entrances of arched stone at each of the cardinal points of the compass. Anya slowed down as she approached an entryway, not wanting to call attention to herself, and then stopped in the shadow of the arch to look out across the plaza. She saw a porter almost immediately. He was hard to overlook in that white suit he favored. He was standing on the far side of the square in the shade of an umbrella that was held by an extremely fit-looking man next to him who all but screamed former military. For a moment, she thought they had seen her as well. She tensed, ready to dive back into the crowd. When they didn't react after several seconds, she relaxed and settled in to wait for the thief. Several minutes passed. Then he appeared in the mouth of the arch to her right, just as she'd expected he would. He glanced out across the crowd, obviously looking for someone. When his gaze fell on Porter, Anya saw his expression of distaste before he adopted an obviously fake smile.
You know you've got a personality problem when even hired thieves don't like you.
The youth lifted a hand in greeting and then crossed to Porter. That was enough for Anya. Now it was time to take back what was hers. She left the concealment of the arch behind and put herself on an intercept course with her target. Porter's gunman picked her out of the crowd. One look was all it took for him to identify the oncoming threat. He drew his gun and pointed it at her.
He won't shoot. Not with this many witnesses.
Anya felt the bullet pass by her left ear. As Anya watched, the thief turned to see what Porter's bodyguard was shooting at, and their gazes locked above the heads of the crowd. He ran back the way he had come. Anya flicked her gaze to the gunman just in time to see Porter knock the other man's arm upward. The bullet thwacked harmlessly into the wall of a nearby building. Dodging panicked market-goers and anxious animals, Anya took off after her target. He tried to lose her in the maze of outdoor shops and stalls, but Anya matched him turn for turn. Her quarry was starting to get desperate. His head was snapping this way and that, as he frantically looked for some way of throwing her off his trail. They were passing a wide fountain to their left, an ornate stone affair with an elephant sitting in the pool of water, spouting water out of his trunk. As they came abreast of it, the young thief flung the package away. Then he cut sharply in the opposite direction. Anya watched the package sail through the air and into the fountain. She had no choice but to go in after it. Bystanders watched as she jumped into the murky water and splashed her way over to where she'd seen the package disappear. She spent a few anxious minutes searching with both arms plunged beneath the surface before her fingertips brushed plastic.
Yes!
She snatched the package out of the water as she straightened. The thief, of course, was long gone. Porter and his man had apparently decided to make themselves scarce as well. As she climbed out of the fountain, her clothes sopping wet from the thighs down, she realized that the packaging had torn slightly at some point during the chase. Water had most likely reached the drawing inside.
No! Damn it!
She stripped the packaging open, wiped one hand dry on the top half of her shirt, and then used it to pull the painting out. She saw immediately that one corner of the image had some water damage, but thankfully it wasn't extensive, only about the size of a half-dollar piece, if that. With a little care, she might even be able to restore it. To keep it from getting any worse, she quickly took off the wooden backing and then removed the drawing from the frame entirely. There was nothing left for Anya to do but return to her hotel. Once there, the management apologized profusely for the break-in and moved her to another suite on a different floor to keep it from happening again. Anya wasn't happy to find that her belongings had already been sent to the new room. Having two sets of strangers pawing through her things in a single evening was not one of the night's high points. On the other hand, she was glad she wouldn't have to spend the next hour gathering up her things. She needed a shower to wash off the grit and grime she'd picked up during her dunking in the fountain, but didn't want to let the drawing out of her sight, so she compromised by taking it into the bathroom with her and wrapping it in a spare towel to keep it from getting damp. After bathing, she dressed in a pair of sweats and a tank top and took the bundle over to the sitting area for a closer look. The corner of the drawing that had gotten wet had separated, the top layer of paper lifting up and curling away from the one below it.
Huh.
Anya stared at it in puzzlement for a moment before picking it up to get a better look. On closer inspection, she could see that they were actually two different pieces of paper, carefully fitted and glued together. Anya took the drawing back into the bathroom and laid it on a towel at the edge of the sink. She turned the shower on full blast, hot. After making sure the drawing was far enough away from the shower to keep it from getting wet, she took a towel from the rack and left the room, closing the door behind her. She then laid the extra towel against the bottom of the door, effectively trapping as much steam inside the room as possible. Now there was nothing more to do but wait. She paced back and forth in front of the bathroom door for just over 15 minutes. Then she opened the door and let all the heat and humidity out of the room. As the steam cleared out, she got her first look at the drawing. The top layer had curled up and separated from the layer below it, leaving her with two rolled tubes of parchment-like canvas. A quick glance told her that the new layer also contained a hand-drawn image. Anya took them both out to the sitting area so she could examine them in detail. She set aside the top layer and turned her attention to the newly revealed image on the second layer of parchment. It was a series of images, arranged one above the other in a vertical line. They were crudely drawn by hand, but recognizable nonetheless. The first was a building of some kind. Two diagonal lines joined together to form a roof over two vertical lines that formed the walls. Written in the center was the notation DM. The second image looked like the old pirate symbol of a skull and crossbones, but in this case the skull had been replaced by the head of an elephant. The third symbol was of a baobab, the large fruit-bearing tree that could be found in Africa, India, and parts of Australia. The baobab stored hundreds of gallons of water in its trunk and was thought to live several thousand years. But what really caught Anya's attention was the fourth and final image. It took up most of the lower third of the page and was carefully drawn as if the viewer were standing in the opening of a cave, looking out into a massive canyon filled with earthen buildings painted in brilliant colors. She knew instinctively she was looking at the image of the lost city that Humphrey had intended to find when he set off on his final expedition. A verse was written below the image.
The tulip stands amid the wild beasts. Within its walls, the first of the answers you seek. Find the gray crown that watches over the flock to receive a piece of the puzzle you hope to unlock.
It's a map!
The images, combined with the riddle-like verse, were clues to the route Humphrey had planned to take to find the lost city.
No wonder Porter wants it so badly.
If she could unravel the clues Humphrey had left behind, Anya was confident she could retrace his steps and discover once and for all what had happened to him during that final fateful expedition. As the night burned on toward morning, Anya got to work.